Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, November 29th, 2018, approaching very quickly the sacred holiday of Christmas. And no, it's not for shopping. That's not the original idea. Anyway, I'll be talking tonight about Van Allen belts, a little bit about some Tesla activity going on. I'll be talking about election fraud in the making and past and future. And also Fukushima. 60 Minutes did a special on Fukushima. And I believe this just aired this past Sunday. But as you can imagine, the official story has been completely, let's say, molded for the general public. And you got the officials, the top officials, none of whom were there at the time, and none of whom talk about the real situation behind the scene at Fukushima and the incidents that led up to the earthquake. The fabrication that it was a 9.0 earthquake. I mean, this thing gets bigger every time they announce it. A 9.0 earthquake is told by Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes. And it was not. It was a 5-point earthquake, and it was felt. Now, this is the strange thing. They show the site of a woman running around and the walls shaking. And this was in northern Japan. Remember, the earthquake and the tsunami originated in northern Japan. And so the level of earthquake, it was a 5.0, not a 9.0. That's like four orders of magnitude. That's like 10,000 times different between a 5 and a 9 magnitude. And now this is the new modified Richter scale. It used to be one less. And so now if it's a 9, it's a more powerful than what a 9 used to be. Okay, so anyway, that's a different story. But the earthquake that actually happened at the Fukushima Daiichi electrical plant site, the site of the four nuclear reactors, was not that intense. And then they show the tsunami in the northeastern corridor of Japan, where it came in along a shoreline. And there was a lot of damage at the shoreline. And, of course, the Fukushima power plants are right at the shoreline. But there was a big warehouse between the power plant and the ocean. And I've seen the actual video. Now, this is so disinformation. What they showed is the tsunami coming into northern Japan, not at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. If they did, the people would go, well, this is not a big deal. Because there were a number of waves that came in, and by the time they got to Fukushima, they were coming in as a glancing blow, so to speak. And so the waves, if you're familiar with waves and wave technology, the waves were going by, not coming at the shore. So the reality is, if you have the opportunity to see the real tsunami as it hit Fukushima, the waves rolled in and out, and it was the very clear when you see these things exploding, that's not how nuclear power plants would explode, like an explosion straight up. That was a detonated power plant. Those were demolitions. And so what they showed on the 60 Minutes special was complete fabrication. And then, of course, they have their American on-site specialist expert with the skinny little tie and the glasses on-site to tell you that everything is okay and they're working hard to clean this site up. Now, I've talked about this topic many times on the radio. My physics degree, my advanced physics degree, is in nuclear and solid-state physics, so it's something I know a little bit about. And when this first happened, I said that what I was asked on radio shows what to do. And what you do is you have to put neutron receptors down into the molten cores to slow down the ongoing nuclear reaction. And then you can start to haul this stuff out of there. But they're talking about 30 years and a couple hundred billion dollars. Now, the Nuclear Regulatory Commissions, the AEC, the whole laundry list of national and international boards of control over nuclear power are totally negligent. Let's just put it that way. This plant could have been stopped, plugged up, and cured hours after the initial explosion, because the initial explosion put a lot of radioactivity into the air. And the reason is there were 600,000 spent nuclear fuel rods on the roofs being cooled. And so anyway, let's talk about the power plants. What would they look like if they actually melted down? You would see a rolling puff of smoke and the roof caving in first, not blowing straight up. At any rate, and then there are reports that there was a naval vessel that went in offshore filled with military U.S. military personnel, all who received heavy doses of radiation and subsequently died, that does not hit the mainstream media. But when you look at the 60 Minutes piece, to the average person, it would look fairly convincing, as with most doctored stories that you get in the news. They do. They do a very good job of painting a picture that the average person would swallow hook, line, and sinker. But if you know the history, if you know the other extenuating circumstances, number one, it was a 5.0, it was not a 9.0 earthquake. And those values were registered on international seismic stations. Okay, so that's the first thing. By the time that earthquake got to Fukushima, now the earthquake, like I said, was off the northeast corner of Japan. Fukushima is a long ways down the coastline. It would have probably been a 4 or a 3, in other words, a mild shake. And of course, that facility was built to withstand much, much more than that. So it certainly was not the earthquake. The tsunami waves, by the time they came down the coastline and approached the shoreline where Fukushima Daiichi plants were located, it was coming sideways to the coastline, not directly at it. And if you actually see the video, almost like a high tide coming in. It kind of slides in and slides back out. And certainly nothing that would shut down and black out a nuclear power plant. So anyway, the evidence does not fit the prognosis. The story that they're painting, and that they don't put any blame on the U.S. president at the time, who should have been moving large international entities to the site to clean it up. They did nothing. Just like they did with the BP oil spill in the Florida Gulf, they did nothing. And so those continued for a long period of time. In fact, as I understand it, the BP oil spill is still going on in the Florida Gulf. The cap that they tried to put on there did not work. Okay, so anyway, give you a future, yeah, it's going to take billions of dollars to clean up that plant. But now imagine that the U.S. plants, over 100 of them, which are still active nuclear power plants, which are way past their scheduled certification limit of time, they're burning fuel that they were never designed to burn. They are leaking like a sieve. The majority of them, they don't know how bad the leaks are. and the slush fund that all of these electrical companies are supposed to be putting into a national slush fund to decommission these power plants is certainly not enough in today's dollars. And I'll bet you $1 million that the money that's supposed to be there to decommission nuclear power plants is not there. And that's why they keep extending the commission on nuclear power plants, because they don't want to face the piper that somebody has walked off with the money to decommission these. And who's going to pay the bill? Well, I've talked about the finances of centralized power. The nuclear power plants are way over budget. Not just a little bit. They're way over budget. And they're way behind on maintenance. So you combine those two factors, it's like you had a house and you never painted the front steps. You never fixed the gutter where the water was leaking in, or the roof where the water was leaking in the roof. You never fixed the furnace or the piping of the furnace. You did not, just the list could go on and on. That's what our nuclear power plant fleet is like. It's a disaster. And the issue of how should we power this country, first of all, it should be powered by alternative energy, but of course, those have been ripped off by General Electric, Siemens, and Vesta, and other companies who have sold this three-blade wind generator farce to the public. And the solar panel farce that has been sold to the public. And so what we're left with is coal. And so Trump is very correct in that the only real long-term solid solution towards electrical power in the United States is coal. Because natural gas is being, the fracking is producing a tremendous amount of natural gas at this time, but that's in about 2 to 3 years going to run out, because they're selling it all to China to feed China's almost insatiable appetite for energy to build their economy and maintain it in a power that's equal to the United States. They need vast amounts of energy. So back to the United States, the power companies are near failure. Okay, so I've talked about this before. Just to mention, people have written in about this. There's anytime something gets a lot of publicity in the science world, in the media, you probably can bet there's some BS associated with it. There's a group in Texas that claims they're going to rejuvenate Tesla's idea of transmitting energy through the air. And let me explain something. That's not what Tesla was doing. So right away, you know that this is a farce. And associated with the board of directors and other top-level corporate entities associated with this company called Visiv. But anyway, the bottom line is, if you see something that actually gets mainstream media attention, then it is a farce. It is not. And the reality is, something that I know a bit about is Tesla's work. I'm the one that actually rejuvenated this. My book that came out in around 2002, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And I know I got a lot of input from people in the field that were tier one scientists, knowing that what I was talking about was correct. So the question is, and it still is, and the myth of Tesla trying to transmit energy was, where was he getting the energy to transmit? Now, that's a very interesting question, given that Tesla had sold the rights to his generation equipment to Westinghouse. And the story is very familiar for the people who know about it. When Tesla signed the contract, he made a clause in there that he could use energy as much as he wanted from the Westinghouse grid to power his experiments, and when he got done, he would put the energy back. And so the point is that he was using the energy to power up his Tesla tower to connect to the ionosphere to gather energy, in a sense, freely, not free energy. This is not the put a box on a table and energy flows through the ether. No, this is a, literally, he knew that there was a far end to the capacitor that you could measure down on planet Earth. He knew that. But we had no flying capability to get up to the edge of the ionosphere, which he knew was there, but he knew how to tap into it. So anyway, I'm not going to go through that whole story again. But for the people who still want to try and convince you that Tesla was going to transmit energy through the air, it's completely a farce. Because where was Tesla going to get the energy to transmit? I mean, there was no source of energy. So why would you have a transmitter that could transmit energy with no source of energy? And that explains in one sentence why what the government is trying to pawn off on you and the alleged association of big-name government defense people with this poofy-doof little front agency company down in Texas trying to reproduce Tesla's work is a farce. Okay, so please don't send me any more of that garbage. Anything you see in the mainstream media regarding Tesla is constructed and manipulated, okay? So enough of that. I don't want to waste any more my valuable showtime on that. This is an interesting story here. Russia is going to mount a space program specifically designed to visit the Apollo, the alleged Apollo landing sites, and do what has been needed for a very long period of time since the alleged Apollo landing had have occurred, or at least allegedly occurred. I got to say that word allegedly a lot of times. But the head of Roscosmos declared that the Russian space agency was going to send missions to see if, in fact, the United States had gone to the moon. And there's more than just locating some goods up there, which, there's a lot to verify. And, of course, now that we have some footage, there's some footage of the moon location. Does it correspond with whatever location? That's why when the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter went around the moon and supposedly was supposed to take pictures of the lunar surface and the surrounding area of the Apollo landing sites. Now, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter was in fairly low lunar orbit. It had extremely high-resolution cameras, and what they showed us looked like a couple of pixels etched into the photograph with some pencil chicken scratching, allegedly, where the lunar rover, the Cadillac that the alleged Apollo astronauts allegedly took to the moon and allegedly drove around on the moon. So anyway, the Russians were going to go. But I can tell you right now that if they find and then report nothing, that there is no such thing as Apollo landers on the moon, or that it's a farce, or that they take pictures that don't correspond at all with what the footage or photos are of the alleged Apollo landings, then the Western press will deny it. They will simply go into denial mode. It would almost take an independent country like, say, India. And, of course, India, China, China would be a better one because of the Cold War with the United States. Russia never would be considered a legitimate third independent party to go and check on this. It would be like some drug company checking its fellow drug company reports of drug tests or something. They have an incentive, an apparent incentive to lie about it. So, but anyway, I thought that was interesting. and I don't know how serious this story is. But the article, of course, printed in the Western Press, calls any belief that NASA didn't go to the moon a conspiracy theory. That's that favorite term developed back in the 1940s to name brand anything that doesn't correspond with the official government record. And as, of course, my official statement on this entire scenario is that NASA made a scientific claim. It's probably the biggest scientific claim ever made in the history of man, that they went to the moon repeated times between 1969 and 1976, and they had 6 flights and 18 men launched, and that would put a dozen men on the moon. They have no verification of this. Their photos are fake. They even have admitted it. They've destroyed all the paperwork associated, all the records, all of the hardware, and the only thing that apparently is left is a scale model of the lunar lander in the Smithsonian with little astronaut men, like miniature-sized astronaut men in the model. So anyway, yeah, none of this makes any sense at all. But this is something I'll be tracking. We'll see if, in fact, the Russians go up there to check it out. Okay, just a couple things here on the back to the United States space program, manned space program, the Orion spacecraft. There was an article this week in space.com where NASA has given a $5,000 prize and four runner-ups have split a $7,000 prize to mitigate radiation in outer space. And they say that none of the solutions that were offered, and now when I see this, it's kind of like a joke. I mean, you can't be really serious about the lives of astronauts going into outer space if you give a $5,000 prize. I mean, how about $5 million? And the other four runner-up get split $7 million or something like that. That would make sense. But $5,000? And you're expecting some kind of quality proposal to mitigate radiation in outer space? But then it begs the question, NASA has spent billions, with a B, on this exact topic. They had a program for probably a decade called Living with a Star. I don't see much of that anymore. It used to be thick in the EOS, the American Geophysical Union newsletter that I get regularly. It used to be in like every issue, and then it just kind of faded away. They had chemists, nuclear physicists, physicists, astrophysicists, everybody on the planet trying to figure out what to do about space radiation. And, of course, that is the big problem. But then coming back to the Van Allen belts, and interestingly enough, space.com also this week had an article on the Van Allen belts and how they, let me just, instead of trying to explain what the line of BS they're trying to pawn off on you, let me explain something about the Van Allen belts, which were discovered post-World War II. They sent up a spacecraft. It measured them, or simply a Geiger counter and a tape recorder, literally, that recorded the data. And they discovered there was a high radiation region around Earth. And then they understood that there were two layers. Now, let's just look at what is going on there. In a magnetic field, electrons and protons, primarily these are the primary subatomic particles that are common in outer space in the solar system, they go into basically an orbit in a magnetic field. So they're trapped in Earth's magnetic field in orbit, not gravitational, but magnetic orbits. And the protons go one way, and the electrons go the other way. And so the issue is that these are not just average electrons and protons, they're relativistic. They contain a lot of energy. They're fed through input that come in. Now this, if you understand the plasma discharge comet model and the Earth, the electrons that are coming in from the sun in the discharge of the solar capacitor, they're coming in and they can bleed through the nose end of the Earth's protective magnetic sheath. That's about 35,000 miles out to the sunward side of Earth. And so they come in and these are, they just penetrate the Earth's magnetic field at that point is too weak, so they just penetrate directly in. And then they become entrapped in this orbit around Earth in the Earth's magnetic field. And it's the what we call the geomagnetic field. But it is, of course, there are five layers to that. The Van Allen belt layer of the magnetic field is just one of the layers of our plasma magnetic field. Okay, so anyway, that's what it is. These are electrons and protons, but primarily electrons because of the fact that, going back to the plasma discharge comet model, of which Earth is a good example, it's discharging the solar capacitor, the primary charge carrier is electrons. And so that's why you see primarily electrons in the Van Allen belts. Okay. And their energy fluctuates with solar storms, etc., and they can also bleed off. So the bottom line is the Van Allen belts are like donut-shaped rings around the Earth that have spaces between them, and they're at varying energy levels. But the main point is that they vary in size. They're like an accordion. They're coming in, they're going out, they're getting more dense. The energy of the electrons is changing. And as you sample the electrons at various energies, the various energy electrons are in different regions, which makes sense because they're coupled in this magnetic field, and they're also generating their own magnetic field. So the end result, however, relative to space travel, is that they are changing all the time in their level of intensity, and it's certainly not something that it was even considered, let alone measured, back in the Apollo days. NASA did not have rockets that were going up into that region. They did not have data. They did not have information. But now NASA's excuse is, how did the alleged Apollo astronauts get through the Van Allen belts? Now they're claiming, oh, there was a special crack in the Van Allen belts where they were able to get through with minimal amount of damage to the astronauts. And it's just so absolutely ridiculous when you understand that the Van Allen belts are changing constantly. And the launch time for the Apollo program was not based, or were there any considerations given to Van Allen belt changes or dimensions or energies or where a little crack was, as they call it. It was based on the timing to get them around Earth and then send them off to lunar orbit and to the moon. That's what it was based on. It was based on many factors, but it was not based in any shape or form on Van Allen belt activity, of which NASA really had extremely little knowledge or data. Here's another factor. Is that I learned from the Russians, that the issue was the Russians sent cosmonauts in the 1960s, and that was another piece of disinformation in this space.com article about the Van Allen belts, is that they said, they made this claim that Russia had four attempts to go to the moon, and four times their rocket blew up, and so they quit. Let me tell you something. Russia had launches 2 and 3 per day during that whole the Gemini program time period, the Apollo time. We were waiting 6 months to a year and a half for the next launch to occur. And Russia was going up into space 2 or 3 times a day. And so to think that they had 4 rocket failures on a lunar launch program is absurd. Absolutely just fabricated news. So, that, you know, fake science news is alive and well in the United States. But the real issue was that in the 1960s, the Russians sent men to the moon, and they had fully capable the rockets, and the they had been in space. All they had to do is just redirect it to orbit around the moon and come back, not even land on the moon. And their people came back very dead because of extreme radiation. And so, and I know that from speaking to Russians, and the Russian scientists know this. And so they know that you just don't go through a crack in the radiation belts. But as long as NASA can, and going back to this Orion program, where NASA claims it's going to have its first manned launch in 2022, and of course that will get pushed back, every year that they can push that back farther is another year they just get their salary and don't do anything. Okay, well, enough of that. Enough of manned space programs. I wanted to pick up one point when I was talking last week, the Thanksgiving show, when I was talking about the Christ. This is Mark, the biblical reference, Mark chapter 13, verses 24 to 36. And this is the famous end day sermons when the Christ was at the Mount of Olives. And the way this started, and this is something I didn't clarify last week, so just go back and listen to that show. I'm not going to repeat it. As I explained the significance of what Christ was saying there. But the way this all started is the apostles, they were coming out of a temple. And one of the apostles was remarking about how well the temples were built, the stone structures, and how well they were built and how beautiful they were. And Christ comes back and he goes, you know, someday there's not going to be a stone left upon a stone here. All this is going to be on the ground. He said, so, you know, this is not, there's going to be a day when this stuff just all comes tumbling down in a single day. And the apostles come back and go like, whoa, this is news to us. Tell us more. And so that's when he starts in what is biblical circles or in learned circles, what is known as the end day prophecies. And Christ lays it out on the line. He says, you know, you look up in the heavens for the signs. And he said, the stars will seem to fall from the sky. The firmament will be shaken, which means the sky and the earth. The stars will seem to fall from the sky. And those are the meteor streams. What he's describing there is a big comet coming close to earth. And he said, then the coming on the cloud will be the Son of Man to judge the living and the dead. And that's the way it goes. But it starts by the his followers commenting on this beautiful, well-built structure. And he goes, there ain't going to be none of this left, not a stone upon a stone. That's the way that little episode starts. So I wanted to comment on that. And once again, this is not something that happens over the period of years or months. He says, this is going to come down, boom. And he says, nobody knows the time. Nobody knows when this is going to happen. So it's going to come in fast and hard, and it's going to be devastating. But he also says, there's going to be a tribulation before this, in which earth is just lowered into, and it's very clear that it'll be a political, not only a physical tribulation, but it'll be like a political tribulation brought by man upon himself. And he says if it wasn't cut short, nobody would survive this thing. So interesting. And there's no indication. The great part about this is, of course, they say, well, when's this going to happen? He says nobody knows when. And so the point, one of the big points here is you're constantly hearing people, you know, predicting the end of the world or the financial collapse or whatever else. You know, I probably saw five of these in the last day doing internet searches of imminent financial collapse or or imminent, the Jupiter alignment and a destruction, or imminent on and on and on baloney. You know, it just doesn't end. And of course, the old Planet X days, thank goodness those are over. The issue of Planet X still exists, the real issue, and that is that NASA is not saying anything. Things could come in at any time from any direction, and the likelihood that it's going to interact closely with Earth is very small. But, this end-day prophecy is very interesting because it's a carryover from the Old Testament, the Daniel old end-day prophecies, but then also that the Colbran, which really is this a set of books of learned people back around the time of Christ. That Colbran comes from the books in the library of Joseph of Arimathea, who is, by the way, the guy that asked for Christ's body after the crucifixion, who was Mary's uncle, Mary the mother of Christ's uncle. And Christ spent some time with that guy. I can guarantee you Christ was probably in England when he was young. Not probably, there's no question that he was up at the Glastonbury Abbey, not like Glaston, which what is a town in Vermont or something. Glastonbury Abbey in England, it later became the Glastonbury Abbey. But that's where Joseph of Arimathea hung out, and he was a trader in metals. He was moving metals out of England over into the Roman Empire at the time. And so his book set later became the library at Glastonbury, and when it was burned, the remnants of the library were salvaged, and that is what eventually became the Colbran. Not the Colbran Bible, but simply a collection of books. And very clearly in the Colbran, it talks about the destruction of Earth and literally everything Christ talks about. So he was very much tuned, obviously. He was very tuned to these things. And that's clear also from the time when he was 12. Okay, here he is, 12 years old. In they go to the temple for a religious ceremony, and Mary thinks that Christ is with Joseph, and Joseph thinks that Christ is with Mary. Remember that incident? And so they get together after the weekend or whatever the time period was. And they go, well, I thought he was with you. No, I thought he was with you. And they start looking around. And they come into the courtyard. And here he is. He's sitting down with the secret society. And he's teaching these guys. These are the old Egyptian, basically secret society priests. And Christ is teaching them. And Mary and Joseph come up and say, Jesus, what's going on? What are you doing? And the head secret society guy says, where does this kid get all his information? Because they didn't know. They did not know a lot about the history, and Christ did. So it was very interesting. Those are all those incidents. You know, when I go to church or I go to sermons or I hear people, there is so much left out of the history of Christ and the history of the world. It is just pathetic. I mean, they read these passages and you know, the word of the Lord, okay, great, okay, now what? They don't teach you jack in these religions. I hate to tell you that. And the people go there and they go through the motions of praying, and half of them are not decent Christians at all. They would I'm not going to go there. Excuse me. I'm off on a tangent here. But the reality is that these fine details of Christ's life are very important, and they're totally bypassed by modern churches. Okay, so on to the next topic. Just a little review here on Comet 46P Wirtanen. I've been calling it Wirtman. It's Wirtanen, And so I apologize for that. Just too many things going on in my life. 46P Wirtanen comet is coming. Closest approach to Earth on December 16th, they're saying now. So it's a little bit ahead of schedule. But the original estimate was the December 17th. But at that time, I'm going to explain what the night sky is going to be like. And I'm going to preface this by saying that this is not going to be some kind of Earth-affecting comet. We should be able to get a good view on this. And I also thought it was comical. A long time ago, back in the early 2000s, there were a set of comets that came in. And, of course, NASA was asleep at the throttle, as usual. And I mounted an international comet viewing, basically an organization, not really organization, but just organized international amateurs, astronomers, to send me information on the comets. And the interesting part of these comets was that we were going to get a broadside view, a very good broadside view, and because of other factors, they should have had very distinctive sunward spikes, which would prove, well, first of all, disprove the dirty snowball comet model and prove the plasma discharge comet model that I said would indicate this sunward spike. And so the people, I had an email address set up specifically for this. Well, it was raided, and the people contacted, I had people that I later was able to get information. They said they were contacted and threatened. And in the interim, NASA began its own observation program and data assembly where all the amateurs were supposed to send in their pictures to NASA and not to me. And so anyway, I find it comical now that every time a comet is coming around, NASA, Johnny on the spot to make sure all of the amateurs send their pictures to NASA. And woe be the day that if somebody sent a picture of a comet to me. Okay, well anyway, this is, of course, they have the Ice Ball Comet Model BS coming thick and from, you know, major PhD type people in the astronomy world. But for the rest of us peons out here, I'll just give the sky conditions, what this is going to be like on December 16th. So we are December 15th, let me put it this way, is going to be the last phase of the moon as it goes up to full moon. The last quarter of the moon is pending. So that means you're going to have, in the early part of the evening, you're going to have a very bright moon from about 40 to 75% over the following days of the lunar brilliant light in the night sky. So you're not going to see this comet in the evening or in the any time up to about 1 in the morning. So you're going to have to get up early in the morning after the moon goes down to get a glimpse of this. Now, it'll be visible in the constellation Taurus. So with that, you'll need a little bit of help. Go online or get a star chart, etc. Find out where the constellation Taurus is. And this may be visible to the naked eye. It'll certainly be visible for amateur astronomers with telescopes. But let me just give you some dates here. When the moon sets, 1 o'clock a.m. on the 16th, 2 o'clock a.m. on the 17th, and around 2:40 a.m. on the 19th. So those are that's kind of like your viewing window for this particular comet. So locate Taurus, the constellation Taurus, and also you can get star charts with this comet listed on the internet, and understand that on the 16th, the moon sets at 1 in the morning, then on the 17th, 2 in the morning, on the 18th, about 3 in the morning, etc. And so that after that time, you can potentially see this comet. So it gives you a fairly small window of observation. And if you have telescopes or binoculars, that's also a time when you could look for this particular comet. Now, it is within the 10th, the top 10 closest comets to come to Earth in history. And, of course, that does not include Venus, which we don't know how close Venus got, but it got pretty close, I can tell you that. It rubbed noses with Earth. I doubt if they touched, but it was probably fairly close to do the damage that we know was written about by the ancients when Venus, the comet, came through the solar system. Okay, but this comet is a small comet. It's 30 lunar distances, and action at a distance should not be really a factor. 30 lunar distances, that's about 7 to 8 million miles is the estimate. But comets can be much larger electrically, even though the nucleus, they say, is only maybe a mile across or something like that, or 1.2 kilometers. I've seen various numbers. But it could turn out to be a fairly bright comet, because this particular comet has a history of variability. So we'll just have to see. It could be a rather interesting light show, but as I said, not a potential for any kind of Earth damage. But we could get, this is a possibility, we could get some electrical interaction, because Earth's magnetic field extends out considerable ways. And just to give you a feel for this, the moon, when it orbits the Earth, the only time the Earth and moon interact electrically, as far as Earth's sheath is concerned, its magnetosheath, is during a short period of time during the full moon, in and around the full moon. Other than that, the moon is free from our magnetic field and is interacting with Earth, etc. But, and of course, if you've read my weather book, you understand that the new moon is a time at which, actually the couple days after the new moon, is a time at which we get some trigger activity in Earth's magnetosphere that could trigger storm activity on Earth if it's associated with other discharge factors in the solar system, like the August return current sheet or an alignment, electrical alignment with another planet, etc. Okay, so but that's not the case. But the point here is that the moon, one lunar distance, is outside of really a reactionary point from Earth. But the comet, being 30 lunar distances, probably won't interact electrically with Earth. But there's really no way of knowing. If it does send some sparking activity our way, that would be rather interesting. And we'll just have to wait and see. But what would that look like? That could look like auroras up in the region of sky pointing up towards Taurus. And primarily auroras, or potentially, if it was a large enough discharge, it could affect weather all the way down to the troposphere. But as I said, from the initial information that I have, that I can determine from my own theoretical work, it's a pretty remote possibility. So it looks like this is going to be just a visual show, but interesting to keep your eyes out. And also the possibility of a sunward spike, you know, as this comet moves through its orbit. But there again, this is not what you'd call a prime example of a comet that would develop a sunward spike. Okay, so anyway, that is on December 16th. If you're planning, if you plan ahead, just letting you know that you have to go out after the moon sets to get any visibility of this comet at all. I said at the beginning of the show I would comment on election fraud. And this is something I've studied since the beginning of the 2016 election, presidential election, from before the election, then after the election, then the I have had some commentary on various radio shows regarding the 2018 midterms. But the cheating that has been going on has been extensive and is unabated, and that's the problem. There's nobody really looking into this. It's a serious problem. They did catch people. They actually caught people red-handed in the 2018 election trying to fix votes. One national example was down in Florida. The woman who was basically had all of these votes hidden that they could bring out in recounts, etc., if necessary. So they caught them red-handed. So these are the techniques, and what I found out through various studies, which surprised me, even though I looked at these, I looked at the data, I did regressive analysis, mathematical analysis. What surprised me most was that the biggest level of cheating is at the personnel at the precinct level. That's where the greatest amount of cheating occurs. And I've looked also at cheating that occurs in other countries. Do you think this is only in the United States that people would cheat to have their political party win an election? No, this has been going on since voting began. But in other countries also, the point is that the cheating occurs at the precinct level. That means local people who are there to count the votes and register the votes and pass that number up to the higher level, that's where the bulk of cheating occurs. And how do you stop that? Well, it turns out that in the United States, a lot of the cheating and voting cheating occurred before the election. This was all rigged. This was all planned. These are people that have been doing this for years. They know the routine, how to get boxes full of votes into the recount process where their man wins, and how to have them stacked so that they have the proper number of votes to get the person winning. And I'll just cap this off by saying it's purely on the Democrat side. So the winning the House, like I've said before, the Democrats did not win the House. Hillary Clinton did not win the majority of votes, popular votes in the 2016 election. She got about 17 million votes extra in 10 cheating centers around the United States. Now, these are simply facts. This is not political bias. This is not talking about politics or what the parties represent or political opinions, what's good or bad for the country. This is simply talking about the facts of cheating in elections. Simple. And it's what it really says is there is not a fair election available in the United States. I'll just make a couple comments here about water filters. I got a few minutes left in this particular show because this is right now the last time that you can order and expect something to come before Christmas. I mean, it would have to be today. We would have to get the orders in right away. And that gives us the month of December for shipping. And after that, I will not guarantee any type of shipping by Christmas. So a lot of people it's a really wonderful gift, the gift of water filters to people. Or if you know they have a water filter container, buy them the replacement water filter elements. It's something that people really appreciate because they're very, very professional products, something I'm very proud of over the years and decades. Right now, the GF filters that I'm selling, they are the best filter on the market, bar none. They don't require add-on filters. And also want to stress that the whole house filters are amazing. And really, I think people should really consider those if you're going to have a if you're really considering water filtration as an issue, because here's the problem. If you're washing your clothes, chlorine is very destructive on clothes. So if you're only filtering in your kitchen, you're washing with chlorinated water, and it's very destructive. You know, all that dust in your dryer, that's because your clothes are being destroyed by harsh chemicals that come in on the water. The worst thing, however, is that when you shower, you turn on the shower and the vapor there and a nice hot shower, you are taking that chlorine and fluoride and other chemicals, glyphosates, arsenic. Arsenic is a big problem all over the United States. You can pull up arsenic maps and check your local area, but chances are you have an natural arsenic problem in your water coming from wells. So you got to get that out of your water. But in a shower, you are showering in this. So it's coming through your skin. Your skin is the biggest organ of your body. I don't know if you know that. And it is the most receptive to anything passing through. Plus, you're breathing this on a daily basis. That's if you shower on a regular basis. I hope most of you do. But breathing this, you're breathing toxins, and it's going right into your system, and these are cumulative. So a whole house water filter, the JMCC GF, the whole house water filters, the MR5, it's on sale. You get a very good reduced price on the replacement filter elements when you buy them with the MR5 filter, and you take all of that out for the whole house. For your laundry, for your showers, if you do anything like, say you have a little garden, I hope you're not putting tap water from the city on your organic garden, because good grief, then you're putting all of those chemicals right into the food that you're growing in your organic garden. So anyway, go to the webpage and check out the water filters. Like I say, this is the last week, today, tomorrow, let's say up till Sunday, that we would guarantee that something could be shipped and delivered before Christmas. So the webpage, jmccsci.com, and of course my books are there, all the CDs, DVDs, eDVDs, the calendar, and all of those products, the posters, etc., all on that webpage, jmccsci.com. And by the way, I don't take donations. I don't get funding through the back door. This is how I pay for this radio show, which is commercial free, etc. And it helps pay the bills by selling water filters. So anyway, I hope you go there, find some things that you like, consider them for your Christmas presents. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. We are at the crossroads. Good night.